Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tending the Wild, Native American Knowledge and the Management of California's Natural Resources, by M. Cat Anderson. Narrated by Leslie Howard. Plants are thought to be alive. Their juice is their blood, and they grow. The same is true of trees. All things die. Therefore, all things have life. Because all things have life, gifts have to be given to all things. William Ragonal Benson, Pomo and E. M. Loeb, Pomo Folkways. Preface. The idea that would become the foundation of this book, that Indigenous people's stewardship of the land carries important lessons for us in the modern world, germinated in my mind as I stood in a Mexican farmer's field since summer 1983. Growing alongside the many kinds of crop plants were a variety of native herbs and trees. Insects buzzed and clicked, and birds chattered. The land smelled good and radiated beauty. The farmer was using the land quite intensively, yet much of the natural plant and animal diversity remained. He explained to me the importance of diversifying crops, using locally available resources, retaining overstory trees, and planting vegetation that harbored beneficial insects that would feed on the bad insects. All these farming techniques were starting to catch on among organic farmers in the United States, and to be taught in the new field of agroecology at American universities. And they all had roots in the farming methods of the indigenous people of this and other regions. I began to wonder about the ways in which the native peoples of my home state, California, had managed wildland resources and altered the composition and structure of plant communities to meet their needs for food, clothing, and shelter. Had we underestimated their knowledge and ingenuity, their ability to transform their environment? Just as we had underestimated the value of the indigenous-based traditional farming methods used around the world. I became determined to find out, and decided to focus my graduate study in wildland resource science at the University of California, Berkeley, on what I began to call the indigenous resource management practiced by the First Peoples of California. I spent many months over a 7-year period, 1986 through 92, in the Sierra Nevada, living in towns such as El Portal, Arnold, and North Fork, and interviewing individuals from the southern, central, and northern Sierra Miwok, the Mono from Dunlap, North Fork, and Auberry, and the Choinumni, Chukchansi, Wakchumni, and Yolumni Yokuts tribes. In later years, I spent time among the Pitt River and Washoe. I also interviewed longtime non-Indian residents, many of them from established ranching families. The more elders I talked with, the more I appreciated the importance of what I was learning. The fieldwork involved capturing elders' memories, their stories of how the land used to look and feel, and how it differed from what one sees today. I was excited to hear their descriptions of the old ways of relating to nature, especially the management techniques, for example, burning, pruning, tilling, weeding, and selective harvesting, that they had learned from their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents, and that they were still practicing today. Several important insights were revealed to me as I talked with elders and accompanied them on their plant-gathering walks. The first of these was that one gains respect for nature by using it judiciously. By using a plant or an animal, interacting with it where it lives, and tying your well-being to its existence, you can be intimate with it and understand it. The elders challenged the notion I had grown up with, that one should respect nature by leaving it alone, by showing me that we learn respect through the demands put on us by the great responsibility of using a plant or an animal. Many elders I interviewed said that plants do better when they gather them. At first, this was a jarring idea. I had been taught that native plants were here long before humans and did best on their own without human interference. But it soon became clear to me that my native teachers were giving me another crucial gift of insight. California Indians had established a middle ground between the extremes of overexploiting nature and leaving it alone, seeing themselves as having the complementary roles of user, protector, and steward of the natural world. I had been reading about how various animals' interactions with plant populations actually benefited those plants, how grizzly bears scattered the bulbits of erythronium lilies in the process of rooting up and eating the mature bulbs, how California scrub jays helped oaks reproduce by losing track of some of the acorns they buried. And it seemed plausible that the many generations of humans in California's past had played a similar role. If it was true that native plants did better with our help, it meant that there was a place for us in nature. About halfway into the years of fieldwork, I began to ask native elders, why are many plants and animals disappearing? Their answers, which always pinned the blame on the absence of human interaction with a plant or an animal, began to add up to a third major insight. Not only do plants benefit from human use, but some may actually depend on humans using them. Human tending of certain California native plants had been so repetitive and long-term that the plants might very well have become adapted to moderate human disturbance. This idea had a very practical corollary. The conservation of endangered species and the restoration of historic ecosystems might require the reintroduction of careful human stewardship rather than simple hands-off preservation. In other words, reestablishing the ecological associations between people and nature might be appropriate in certain areas. As I rediscovered the old ways in California, I began to look more broadly at indigenous practices around the world. I found that some of the judicious harvesting and horticultural practices of California indigenous cultures were remarkably similar to those of native peoples in South America, Australia, and Africa. I was intrigued that parallel resource use and management systems had developed independently on different continents. For example, Australian Aborigines and California Indians both used cattail for cordage and other purposes, burning off tool marshes to recycle dead material and spur new growth. Ancient peoples in Egypt cultivated flax to encourage it to produce long, straight stems with longer bast fibers, good for cordage and textiles, much like the first Californians tended patches of dogbane, so that its stems would produce fibers suitable for weaving belts, tump lines, feather capes, skirts, and many other items. There were also important parallels in food production systems. The Mojave in Southern California and the ancient Incas of South America sowed and cultivated the edible seeds of a pigweed in the genus Chenopodium, and many California Indian tribes echoed the practice of the indigenous peoples of Chile by eating the oily seeds of species in the genus Madia and caring for populations of the plants. The Paiute tribe of Owens Valley broadcast edible seeds of chia to thicken stands and introduce the plant to irrigated areas. And we have evidence that chia was sown and regularly cultivated along with corn in ancient Mexico. These parallels indicated to me that our human forebears everywhere did not just passively gather food and basketry materials, but actively tended the plant and animal populations on which they relied. There was no clear-cut distinction between hunter-gatherers, the category into which most California Indians had been tossed, and the more advanced agricultural peoples of the ancient world. Moreover, California Indians had likely completed the initial steps in the long process of domesticating wild species, something that ancient peoples in other lands had always been given sole credit for. Sometime in 1993, while I was finishing my dissertation, I came to realize that what the California Indian elders had been teaching me was so important that it needed to be shared with others. Eventually, I decided that writing a book about the enormous influence of Indian stewardship on the California landscape would serve the interests of indigenous people and enable me to give something back. Most of the existing written information on how California Indians had cared for the land through burning, tilling, sowing, and pruning was not easily accessible. It was widely scattered in handwritten diaries, note cards, and shoeboxes, and correspondence files in many libraries and museums. Even more important, the unwritten knowledge possessed by the Indian elders I was interviewing was endangered. This last generation of people, taught directly by grandparents and great-grandparents born before the gold rush, was made up of elders in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they were beginning to pass away, taking with them a wealth of cultural knowledge about how to relate to the earth. Some of these elders had grown up on traditional foods and still spoke their respective languages. I wanted to put some of the valuable information about Indian stewardship of the land in one place and preserve it for posterity. Now that the book is being published, it is my fervent hope that certain benefits will be realized. First, I hope that greater understanding of the stewardship legacy left us by California Indians will foster a paradigm shift in our thinking about the state's past, particularly with regard to wildland fire and the necessity of prescribed burning in the management of the state's natural resources today. Second, increased appreciation for the diverse indigenous cultures of California could lead to collaborative projects that reestablish access to the land and maintain culturally significant plant resources for the perpetuation of native traditions. Third, experiments and cross-disciplinary studies to determine the thresholds of harvest for native plant species and to assess the degree to which particular ecosystems and plant species are dependent on indigenous disturbance regimes could be launched. In this way, human use can become integrated into conservation and restoration work. Fourth, I would like to encourage people to pursue studies in natural history and ethnobiology, both of which emphasize tactile contact with and direct learning from nature and indigenous peoples. And fifth, we desperately need to foster a new vision of human-nature relationships and the place of humans in the natural world. Those who peopled California before the arrival of Westerners are some of the best teachers. Note on languages, territories, and names of California Indian tribes. The native people of California can be grouped in several different ways. This book references linguistic maps, identifying groups of people that spoke the same language or dialect. Anthropologists have most commonly grouped the native peoples of California in this way, because classification by language is relatively straightforward, and because peoples speaking the same language tend to have other cultural traits in common. However, the bonds between people that share a language are often less important than those created by other sorts of relationships. This was especially true in most of Native California, where the nature of trade, warfare, cooperation, and almost every other kind of interaction depended on whether the individuals involved belonged to the same socio-political group, not whether they spoke a common language. There is thus a disconnect between the linguistic map used here and the groupings that determined day-to-day behavior in Native California, since the individual language groups often comprised many independent socio-political groups. In most cases, everyone in a socio-political unit spoke the same language, but speaking the same language did not ensure membership in the same socio-political unit. The picture in Native California is further complicated because socio-political groups differed in kind and composition across the state, and because these groups were displaced and disrupted by European and American contact and occupation. Prior to contact, many language groups, particularly in Northern California, were subdivided into politically and economically independent groups consisting of several unrelated families that collectively owned and defended a specific tract of land. Alfred Kroeber called these groups village communities or triblets to distinguish these political entities from the more familiar plains tribes, which were much larger and more unified. Triblets spoke a particular dialect, but they were independent from adjoining triblets that spoke the same dialect. In other places, particularly in Southern California and the San Joaquin Valley, otherwise independent socio-political units were somewhat unified by moieties that divided the whole of society into two ritually interdependent halves, forcing them to cooperate in giving first fruit rites and other ritual affairs. In still other places, notably Northwestern California, there were no triblets at all, nor indeed were there any socio-political units larger than the family. This diverse socio-political landscape was drastically transformed by European and American occupation. Many groups disappeared altogether. Many independent groups joined to form new social units. Contributing to this joining and mixing was the policy of the federal government to grant services through the BIA only to groups designated as federally recognized tribes, such as the Big Valley, Hopeland, and Robinson Rancherias among the Pomo, for example. All this explains why a linguistic map does not show all the groups mentioned in the text. Some of the tribal names in use today reflect traditional geographic designations, referring to a characteristic feature or landmark of the place inhabited by the group. The Pitt River tribe, for example, takes its name from that major river. Yet on the linguistic map, the tribe is also called by the name of its language, Achumawi. In this case, there is a one-to-one correspondence between language and political unit. Because the language groups on a linguistic map frequently comprised multiple independent units, and because so few of these were documented by ethnographers, it is impossible to present a comprehensive socio-political map which might show 500 to 600 groups. See Robert Heiser's Languages, Territories, and Names of California Indian Tribes for a more detailed discussion and presentation of data and sources. Because some groups had no specific name for themselves, after all, they knew who they were given the names used by their neighbors, with predictable results when neighboring tribes were not on friendly terms. More common are the names imposed by anthropologists. The Karuk, spelled K-A-R-U-K, for example, have created their name by varying the spelling of K-A-R-O-K, the term used by anthropologists for the tribe's language. Karuk, meaning upriver, was not in use as a tribal name aboriginally. The neighboring Yurik, in turn, take their name from the anthropological name for their language, which was derived from the Karuk term Yurik, meaning downriver. To further complicate matters, there are many variations on the spelling of almost every language group and tribal name. The Choynumne, Choynumne, are also referred to as Choinumni and Choynimni. Frequently, this variation is intentional, as tribal groups change the spelling of terms used by anthropologists. Thus, the Washoe, spelled W-A-S-H-O, of the anthropologist has become the Washoe, W-A-S-H-O-E. Karuk, K-A-R-O-K, K-A-R-U-K. Yalumni, Y-A-W-E-L-M-A-N-I, or Y-A-W-L-U-M-N-E. And Kato, K-A-T-O, or C-A-H-T-O, are other examples of this change. For various tribal names and spellings, see the synonymies in the Handbook of North American Indians. Volumes 8, 10, 11, and 12 cover California, Southwest, Great Basin, and Plateau tribes. In this book, when two tribal memberships are listed for an informant, Mono Dumna, for example, the person claims both language affiliations because one or both parents have that ethnic background. This note is based upon discussions with and comments from anthropologist Robert Bettinger and linguists Victor Galla and Leanne Hinton. Introduction. The New World is in fact a very old world. The mountain forests, broad inland valleys, oak-studded hills and deserts of the region now called California were thoroughly known, celebrated in story and song, named in great detail, and inhabited long before European explorers sailed along the west coast of North America for the first time. Every day of every year for millennia, the indigenous people of California interacted with the native plants and animals that surrounded them. They transformed roots, berries, shoots, bones, shells, and feathers into medicines, meals, bows, and baskets, and achieved an intimacy with nature unmatched by the modern-day wilderness guide, trained field botanist, or applied ecologist. The first European explorers, American trappers, and Spanish missionaries entering California painted an image of the state as a wild Eden, providing plentiful nourishment to its native inhabitants without sweat or toil. But in actuality, the productive and diverse landscapes of California were in part the outcome of sophisticated and complex harvesting and management practices. California Indians protected and tended favored plant species and habitats, harvested plant and animal products at carefully worked out frequencies and intensities, and practiced an array of horticultural techniques. Through coppicing, pruning, harrowing, sowing, weeding, burning, digging, thinning, and selective harvesting, they encouraged desired characteristics of individual plants, increased populations of useful plants, and altered the structures and compositions of plant communities. Regular burning of many types of vegetation across the state created better habitat for game, eliminated brush, minimized the potential for catastrophic fires, and encouraged a diversity of food crops. These harvest and management practices, on the whole, allowed for sustainable harvest of plants over centuries and possibly thousands of years. In other words, California Indians were able to harvest the foods and basketry and construction materials they needed each year while conserving and sometimes increasing the plant populations from which they came. During the course of their long history in California, Indians so exhaustively explored the plant kingdom for its uses and so thoroughly tested nature's responses to human harvesting and tending that they discovered how to use nature in a way that provided them with a relatively secure existence while allowing for the maximum diversity of other species. In the context of the entire continuum of possible human interactions with nature, ranging from exploitation and human-designed environments to hands-off preservation, this relationship between the indigenous people of California and the natural world represented a middle way, a calculated, tempered use of nature. Tending the Wild explores how California Indians managed economies that occupied this middle portion of the continuum. It recasts them as active agents of environmental change and stewardship, shattering the hunter-gatherer stereotype long perpetuated in the anthropological and historical literature of California. The terms hunter-gatherer and forager, inaccurate anthropological labels assigned to most California Indian groups, connote a hand-to-mouth existence. They imply that California Indians dug tubers, plucked berries, and foraged for greens in a random fashion, never staying in any one place long enough to leave lasting human imprints. But as Tending the Wild demonstrates, the indigenous people of California had a profound influence on many diverse landscapes, in particular the coastal prairies, valley grasslands, and oak savannas, three of the most biologically rich plant communities in California. Without an Indian presence, the early European explorers would have encountered a land with less spectacular wildflower displays, fewer large trees, and fewer park-like forests. And the grassland habitats that today are disappearing in such places as Mount Tamalpais and Salt Point State Park might not have existed in the first place. A tended wilderness. Through 12,000 or more years of existence in what is now California, humans knit themselves to nature through their vast knowledge base and practical experience. In the process, they maintained, enhanced, and in part created a fertility that was eventually to be exploited by European and Asian farmers, ranchers, and entrepreneurs, who imagined themselves to have built civilization out of an unpeopled wilderness. The concept of California as unspoiled, raw, uninhabited nature, as wilderness, erased the indigenous cultures and their histories from the land, and dispossessed them of their enduring legacy of tremendous biological wealth. As the environmental historian William Cronin notes, the removal of Indians to create an uninhabited wilderness, uninhabited as never before in the human history of the place, reminds us just how invented, just how constructed the American wilderness really is. John Muir, celebrated environmentalist and founder of the Sierra Club, was an early proponent of the view that the California landscape was a pristine wilderness before the arrival of Europeans. Staring in awe at the lengthy vistas of his beloved Yosemite Valley, or the extensive beds of golden and purple flowers in the Central Valley, Muir was eyeing what were really the fertile seed, bulb, and greens gathering grounds of the Miwok and Yokuts Indians, kept open and productive by centuries of carefully planned indigenous burning, harvesting, and seed scattering. Of course, there were some places that had little or no intervention from native peoples, and these would qualify as true wilderness under the modern definition. The subalpine forests, the drier desert regions of Southern California, the lower salt marsh areas, the beach and dune communities, and the alkali flats and serpentine balds with widely spaced plants do not burn readily, nor do they support large numbers of economically useful plants. In addition, there were areas that were off limits to burning because their favored plants were not fire tolerant, or the terrain was too rugged, or for other reasons. In general, however, most of the plant communities in California were influenced in varying degrees by Indian management. California Indians did not distinguish between managed land and wild land as we do today. The word for wilderness is absent from many tribal vocabularies, as is the word for civilization. Viewed retrospectively, writes Max Olschläger in The Ideas of Wilderness, the idea of wilderness represents a heightened awareness by the agrarian or Neolithic mind, as farming and herding supplanted hunting and gathering, of distinctions between humankind and nature. Interestingly, contemporary Indians often use the word wilderness as a negative label for land that has not been taken care of by humans for a long time. For example, where dense understory shrubbery or thickets of young trees block visibility and movement. A common sentiment among California Indians is that a hands-off approach to nature has promoted feral landscapes that are inhospitable to life. "The white man sure ruined this country," says James Rust, a Southern Sierra Miwok elder. "It's turned back to wilderness." California Indians believe that when humans are gone from an area long enough, they lose the practical knowledge about correct interaction, and the plants and animals retreat spiritually from the earth or hide from humans. When intimate interaction ceases, the continuity of knowledge passed down through generations is broken, and the land becomes wilderness. Indigenous resource management. Resource management is not a modern invention. Indigenous people in California and elsewhere have practiced the roots of this applied discipline for millennia. Our California landscapes, a reflection of historical processes, both natural and cultural, bear the indelible imprint of a medley of management techniques. The major aim of this book is to shed new light on the diverse ways in which Native peoples of California very purposefully harvested, tended, and managed the wild, pruning tobacco patches, burning willow to discourage insect pests, allowing for rest periods between sedge rhizome harvests, and maintaining plants with edible seeds in the understories of open lower montane forests. The foundation of Native peoples' management of plants and animals was a collective storehouse of knowledge about the natural world, acquired over hundreds of years through direct experience and contact with the environment. the rich knowledge of how nature works and how to judiciously harvest and steward its plants and animals without destroying them was hard-earned. It was the product of keen observation.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?